corresponds to a binary 1 or a 0. The labels are arbitrary. When you play the disc, another laser beam reads the pattern of floors, and a special-purpose computer built into the player turns the binary numbers back into sound vibrations, which are amplified so that you can hear them. Although CDs are used mainly for music, you can pack the whole Encyclopedia Britannica onto one of them and read it out using the same laser technique. Flaws in crystals at the atomic level are far smaller than the pits etched in a laser disc surface, so crystals can potentially pack more information into a given area. Indeed, DNA molecules, whose capacity for storing information has already impressed us, are something close to crystals themselves. Although clay crystals theoretically could store the same prodigious quantities of information as DNA or laser discs can, nobody is suggesting that they ever did. The role of clay and other mineral crystals in the theory is to act as the original low-tech replicators, the ones that were eventually replaced by high-tech DNA. They form spontaneously in the waters of our planet without the elaborate machinery that DNA needs, and they develop flaws spontaneously, some of which can be replicated in subsequent layers of crystal. If fragments of suitably flawed crystal later broke away, we could imagine them acting as seeds for new crystals, each one inheriting its parents' pattern of flaws. So, we have a speculative picture of mineral crystals on the primeval Earth showing some of the properties of replication, multiplication, heredity, and mutation that would have been necessary in order for a form of cumulative selection to get started. There is still the missing ingredient of power. The nature of the replicators must somehow have influenced their own likelihood of being replicated. When we were talking about replicators in the abstract, we saw that power might simply be direct properties of the replicator itself, intrinsic properties like stickiness. At this elementary level, the name power seems scarcely justified. I use it only because of what it can become in later stages of evolution, the power of a snake's fang, for instance, to propagate, by its indirect consequences on snake survival, DNA coding for fangs. Whether the original low-tech replicators were mineral crystals or organic direct forerunners of DNA itself, we may guess that the power they exercised was direct and elementary, like stickiness. Advanced levers of power like a snake's fang or an orchid's flower came far later. What might power mean to a clay? What incidental properties of the clay could influence the likelihood that it, the same variety of clay, would be propagated around the countryside? Clays are made from chemical building blocks such as silicic acid and metal ions, which are in solution in rivers and streams having been dissolved, weathered, out of rocks further upstream. If conditions are right, they crystallize out of solution again downstream, forming clays. Actually, the stream in this case is more likely to mean the seeping and trickling of the groundwater than a rushing open river, but for simplicity I shall continue to use the general word stream. Whether or not a particular type of clay crystal is allowed to build up depends, among other things, upon the rate and pattern of flow of the stream. But deposits of clay can also influence the flow of the stream. They do this inadvertently by changing the level, shape, and texture of the ground through which the water is flowing. Consider a variant of clay that just happens to have the property of reshaping the structure of the soil so that the flow speeds up. The consequence is that the clay concerned gets washed away again. This kind of clay, by definition, is not very successful. Another unsuccessful clay would be one that changed the flow in such a way that a rival variant of clay was favoured.
We aren't, of course, suggesting that clays want to go on existing. Always we are talking only about incidental consequences, events which follow from properties that the replicator just happens to have. Consider yet another variant of clay. This one happens to slow down the flow in such a way that future deposition of its own kind of clay is enhanced. Obviously, this second variant will tend to become common because it happens to manipulate streams to its own advantage. This will be a successful variant of clay. But so far we are dealing only with single-step selection. Could a form of cumulative selection get going? To speculate a little further, suppose that a variant of a clay improves its own chances of being deposited by damming up streams. This is an inadvertent consequence of the peculiar defect structure of the clay. In any stream in which this kind of clay exists, large, stagnant, shallow pools form above dams, and the main flow of water is diverted into a new course. In these still pools, more of the same kind of clay is laid down. A succession of such shallow pools proliferates along the length of any stream that happens to be infected by seeding crystals of this kind of clay. Now, because the main flow of the stream is diverted, during the dry season the shallow pools tend to dry up. The clay dries and cracks in the sun, and the top layers are blown off as dust. Each dust particle inherits the characteristic defect structure of the parent clay that did the damming, the structure that gave it its damming properties.
By analogy with the genetic information raining down on the canal from my willow tree, we could say that the dust carries instructions for how to dam streams and eventually make more dust. The dust spreads far and wide in the wind, and there is a good chance that some particles of it will happen to land in another stream, hitherto not infected with the seeds of this kind of dam-making clay. Once infected by the right sort of dust, a new stream starts to grow crystals of dam-making clay, and the whole depositing, damming, drying, eroding cycle begins again. To call this a life cycle would be to beg an important question, but it is a cycle of a sort, and it shares with true life cycles the ability to initiate cumulative selection. Because streams are infected by dust seeds blown from other streams, we can arrange the streams in an order of ancestry and descent. The clay that is damming up pools in stream B arrived there in the form of dust crystals blown from stream A. Eventually, the pools of stream B will dry up and make dust, which will infect streams F and P. With respect to the source of their dam-making clay, we can arrange streams into family trees. Every infected stream has a parent stream, and it may have more than one daughter stream. Each stream is analogous to a body whose development is influenced by dust seed genes, a body that eventually spawns new dust seeds. Each generation in the cycle starts when seed crystals break away from the parent stream in the form of dust. The crystalline structure of each particle of dust is copied from the clay in the parent stream. It passes on that crystalline structure to the daughter stream, where it grows and multiplies, and finally sends seeds out again.
The ancestral crystal structure is preserved down the generations unless there is an occasional mistake in crystal growth, an occasional alteration in the pattern of laying down of atoms. Subsequent layers of the same crystal will copy the same flaw, and if the crystal breaks in two, it will give rise to a subpopulation of altered crystals. Now, if the alteration makes the crystal either less or more efficient in the damming, drying, erosion cycle, this will affect how many copies it has in subsequent generations. Altered crystals might, for instance, be more likely to split, reproduce. Clay formed from altered crystals might have greater damming power in any of a variety of detailed ways. It might crack more readily in a given amount of sun. It might crumble into dust more readily. The dust particles might be better at catching the wind, like fluff on a willow seed. Some crystal types might induce a shortening of the life cycle, consequently a speeding up of their evolution. There are many opportunities for successive generations to become progressively better at getting passed to subsequent generations. In other words, there are many opportunities for rudimentary cumulative selection to get going.
These little flights of fancy, embellishments of Cairn Smith's own, concern only one of several kinds of mineral life cycle that could have started cumulative selection along its momentous road. There are others. Different varieties of crystals might earn their passage to new streams not by crumbling into dust seeds, but but by dissecting their streams into lots of little streamlets that spread around, eventually joining and infecting new river systems. Some varieties might engineer waterfalls that wear down the rocks faster, and hence speed into solution the raw materials needed to make new clays further downstream. Some varieties of crystal might better themselves by making conditions hard for rival varieties that compete for raw materials. Some varieties might become predatory, breaking up rival varieties and using their elements as raw materials. Keep holding in mind that there is no suggestion of deliberate engineering, either here or in modern DNA-based life. It is just that the world automatically tends to become full of those varieties of clay, or DNA, that happen to have properties that make them persist and spread themselves about.
Now to move on to the next stage of the argument. Some lineages of crystals might happen to catalyze the synthesis of new substances that assist in their passage down the generations. These secondary substances would not at first anyway, have had their own lineages of ancestry and descent, but would have been manufactured anew by each generation of primary replicators. They could be seen as tools of the replicating crystal lineages, the beginnings of primitive phenotypes. Ken Smith believes that organic molecules were prominent among non-replicating tools of his inorganic crystalline replicators. Organic molecules frequently are used in the commercial inorganic chemical industry because of their effects on the flow of fluids and on the breakup or growth of inorganic particles, just the sorts of effects, in short, that could have influenced the success of lineages of replicating crystals. For instance, a clay mineral with the lovely name montmorillonite tends to break up in the presence of small amounts of an organic molecule with the less lovely name carboxymethyl cellulose. Smaller quantities of carboxymethyl cellulose, on the other hand, have just the opposite effect, helping to stick montmorillonite particles together. Tannins, another kind of organic molecule, are used in the oil industry to make muds easier to drill. If oil drillers can exploit organic molecules to manipulate the flow and drillability of mud, there's no reason why cumulative selection should not have led to the same kind of exploitation by self-replicating minerals.
At this point, Cairn Smith's theory gets a sort of free bonus of added plausibility. It so happens that other chemists, supporting more conventional organic primeval soup theories, have long accepted that clay minerals would have been a help. To quote one of them, D.M. Anderson,
"It is widely accepted that some, perhaps many, of the abiotic chemical reactions and processes leading to the origin on Earth of replicating microorganisms occurred very early in the history of Earth in close proximity to the surfaces of clay minerals and other inorganic substrates."
This writer goes on to list five functions of clay minerals in assisting the origin of organic life. For instance, concentration of chemical reactants by adsorption. We needn't spell the five out here or even understand them. From our point of view, what matters is that each of these five functions of clay minerals can be twisted round the other way. It shows the close association that can exist between organic chemical synthesis and clay surfaces. It is therefore a bonus for the theory that clay replicators synthesized organic molecules and used them for their own purposes. Cairn Smith discusses, in more detail than I can accommodate here, early uses that his clay crystal replicators might have had for proteins, sugars, and most important of all, nucleic acids like RNA. He suggests that RNA was first used for purely structural purposes, as oil drillers use tannins, or we use soap and detergents. RNA-like molecules, because of their negatively charged backbones, would tend to coat the outside of clay particles. This is getting us into realms of chemistry that are beyond our scope. For our purposes, what matters is that RNA, or something like it, was around for a long time before it became self-replicating. When it finally did become self-replicating, this was a device evolved by the mineral crystal genes to improve the efficiency of manufacture of the RNA, or similar molecule. But once a new self-replicating molecule had come into existence, a new kind of cumulative selection could get going. Originally a sideshow, the new replicators turned out to be so much more efficient than the original crystals that they took over. They evolved further and eventually perfected the DNA code that we know today. The original mineral replicators were cast aside like worn-out scaffolding, and all modern life evolved from a relatively recent common ancestor with a single, uniform genetic system and a largely uniform biochemistry. In The Selfish Gene, I speculated that we may now be on the threshold of a new kind of genetic takeover. DNA replicators built survival machines for themselves, the bodies of living organisms, including ourselves. As part of their equipment, bodies evolved onboard computers, brains. Brains evolved the capacity to communicate with other brains by means of language and cultural traditions. But the new milieu of cultural tradition opens up new possibilities for self-replicating entities. The new replicators are not DNA, and they are not clay crystals. They are patterns of information that can thrive only in brains, or the artificially manufactured products of brains, books, computers, and so on. But given that brains, books, and computers exist, these new replicators, which I called memes to distinguish them from genes, can propagate themselves from brain to brain, from brain to book, from book to brain, from brain to computer, from computer to computer. As they propagate, they can change, mutate, and perhaps mutant memes can exert the kinds of influence that I'm here calling replicator power. Remember that this means any kind of influence affecting their own likelihood of being propagated. Evolution under the influence of the new replicators, mimetic evolution, is in its infancy. It is manifested in the phenomena that we call cultural evolution. Cultural evolution is many orders of magnitude faster than DNA-based evolution, which sets one even more to thinking of the idea of takeover. And if a new kind of replicator takeover is beginning, it is conceivable that it will take off so far as to leave its parent DNA, and its grandparent clay, if Cairn Smith is right, far behind. If so, we may be sure that computers will be in the van.
Could it be that one far-off day, intelligent computers will speculate about their own lost origins? Will one of them tumble to the heretical truth that they have sprung from a remote, earlier form of life rooted in organic carbon chemistry rather than the silicon-based electronic principles of their own bodies? Will a robotic Cairn Smith write a book called Electronic Takeover? Will he rediscover some electronic equivalent of the metaphor of the arch and realize that computers could not have sprung spontaneously into existence, but must have originated from some earlier process of cumulative selection? Will he go on into detail and reconstruct DNA as a plausible early replicator, victim of electronic usurpation? And will he be far-sighted enough to guess that even DNA may itself have been a usurper of yet more remote and primitive replicators, crystals of inorganic silicates? If he is of a poetic turn of mind, will he even see a kind of justice in the eventual return to silicon-based life, with DNA no more than an interlude, albeit one that lasted longer than 3 eons?
That is science fiction, and it probably sounds far-fetched. That doesn't matter. Of more immediate moment is that Cairn Smith's own theory, and indeed all other theories of the origin of life, may sound far-fetched to you and hard to believe. Do you find both Cairn Smith's clay theory and the more orthodox organic primeval soup theory wildly improbable? Does it sound to you as though it would need a miracle to make randomly jostling atoms join together into a self-replicating molecule? Well, at times it does to me too, but let's look more deeply into this matter of miracles and improbability. By doing so, I shall demonstrate a point which is paradoxical, but all the more interesting for that. This is that we should, as scientists, be even a little worried if the origin of life did not seem miraculous, to our own human consciousness. An apparently, to ordinary human consciousness, miraculous theory is exactly the kind of theory we should be looking for in this particular matter of the origin of life. This argument, which amounts to a discussion of what we mean by a miracle, will occupy the rest of this chapter. In a way, it is an extension of the argument we made earlier about billions of planets. So what do we mean by a miracle? A miracle is something that happens but which is exceedingly surprising. If a marble statue of the Virgin Mary suddenly waved its hand at us, we should treat it as a miracle, because all our experience and knowledge tells us that marble doesn't behave like that. If I say, "May I be struck by lightning this minute?" and lightning did strike me in the same minute, it would be treated as a miracle. But actually, neither of these two occurrences would be classified by science as utterly impossible. They would simply be judged very improbable, the waving statue much more improbable than the lightning. Lightning does strike people. Any one of us might be struck by lightning, but the probability is pretty low in any 1 minute. Although the Guinness Book of Records has a charming picture of a Virginian man, nicknamed the Human Lightning Conductor, recovering in hospital from his 7th lightning strike, with an expression of apprehensive bewilderment on his face. The only thing miraculous about my hypothetical story is the coincidence between my being struck by lightning and my verbal invocation of the disaster. Coincidence means multiplied improbability. The probability of my being struck by lightning in any 1 minute of my life is perhaps 1 in 10 million as a conservative estimate. The probability of my inviting a lightning strike in any particular minute is also very low. I have just done it for the only time in the 23,400,000 minutes of my life so far, and I doubt if I'll do it again, so call these odds 1 in 25 million. To calculate the joint probability of the coincidence occurring in any 1 minute, we multiply the two separate probabilities. For my rough calculation, this comes to about 1 in 250 trillion. If a coincidence of this magnitude happened to me, I should call it a miracle and would watch my language in future. But although the odds against the coincidence are extremely high, we can still calculate them. They are not literally zero. In the case of the marble statue, molecules in solid marble are continuously jostling against one another in random directions. The jostlings of the different molecules cancel one another out, so the whole hand of the statue stays still. But if, by sheer coincidence, all the molecules just happen to move in the same direction at the same moment, the hand would move. If they then all reverse direction at the same moment, the hand would move back. In this way, it is possible for a marble statue to wave at us. It could happen. The odds against such a coincidence are unimaginably great, but they are not incalculably great. A physicist colleague has kindly calculated them for me. The number is so large that the entire age of the universe so far is too short a time to write out all the noughts. It is theoretically possible for a cow to jump over the moon with something like the same improbability. The conclusion to this part of the argument is that we can calculate our way into regions of miraculous improbability far greater than we can imagine as plausible.
Let's look at this matter of what we think is plausible. What we can imagine as plausible is a narrow band in the middle of a much broader spectrum of what is actually possible. Sometimes it is narrower than what is actually there. There is a good analogy with light. Our eyes are built to cope with a narrow band of electromagnetic frequencies, the ones we call light, somewhere in the middle of the spectrum from long radio waves at one end to short X-rays at the other. We can't see the rays outside the narrow light band, but we can do calculations about them, and we can build instruments to detect them. In the same way, we know that the scales of size and time extend in both directions far outside the realm of what we can visualize. Our minds can't cope with the large distances that astronomy deals in, or with the small distances that atomic physics deals in, but we can represent those distances in mathematical symbols. Our minds can't imagine a time span as short as a picosecond, but we can do calculations about picoseconds, and we can build computers that can complete calculations within picoseconds. Our minds can't imagine a time span as long as a million years, let alone the thousands of millions of years that geologists routinely compute. Just as our eyes can see only that narrow band of electromagnetic frequencies that natural selection equipped our ancestors to see, so our brains are built to cope with narrow bands of sizes and times. Presumably, there was no need for our ancestors to cope with sizes and times outside the narrow range of everyday practicality, so our brains never evolved the capacity to imagine them. It is probably significant that our own body size of a few feet is roughly in the middle of the range of sizes we can imagine, and our own lifetime of a few decades is roughly in the middle of the range of times we can imagine.
We can say the same kind of thing about improbabilities and miracles. Picture a graduated scale of improbabilities analogous to the scale of sizes from atoms to galaxies, or to the scale of times from picoseconds to eons. On the scale, we mark off various landmark points. At the far left-hand end of the scale are events which are all but certain, such as the probability that the sun will rise tomorrow, the subject of G.H. Hardy's halfpenny bet. Near this left-hand end of the scale are things that are only slightly improbable, such as shaking a double six in a single throw of a pair of dice. The odds of this happening are 1 in 36. I expect we've all done it quite often. Moving towards the right-hand end of the spectrum, another landmark point is the probability of a perfect deal in bridge, where each of the four players receives a complete suit of cards. The odds against this happening are 2 octillion, 235 septillion, 197 sextillion, 406 quintillion, 895 quadrillion, 366 trillion, 368 billion, 301 million, 559,999 to 1. Let's call this 1 delion, the unit of improbability. If something with an improbability of 1 delion was predicted and then happened, we should diagnose a miracle unless, which is more probable, we suspected fraud. But it could happen with a fair deal, and it is far, far, far more probable than the marble statues waving at us. Nevertheless, even this latter event, as we have seen, has its rightful place along the spectrum of events that could happen. It is measurable, albeit in units far larger than gigadelions. Between the double six dice throw and the perfect deal at bridge is a range of more or less improbable events that do sometimes happen, including any one individual's being struck by lightning, winning a big prize on the football pools, scoring a hole-in-one at golf, and so on. Somewhere in this range, too, are those coincidences that give us an eerie, spine-tingling feeling, like dreaming of a particular person for the first time in decades, then waking up to find that they died in the night. These eerie coincidences are very impressive when they happen to us, or to one of our friends, but their improbability is measured in only picodelions.
Having constructed our mathematical scale of improbabilities, with its benchmark or landmark points marked on it, let us now turn a spotlight on that sub-range of the scale with which we, in our ordinary thought and conversation, can cope. The width of the spotlight's beam is analogous to the narrow range of electromagnetic frequencies that our eyes can see, or to the narrow range of sizes, or times, close to our own size and longevity, that we can imagine. On the spectrum of improbabilities, the spotlight turns out to illuminate only the narrow range from the left-hand end, certainty, up to minor miracles like a hole-in-one or a dream that comes true. There is a vast range of mathematically calculable improbabilities way outside the range of the spotlight. Our brains have been built by natural selection to assess probability and risk, just as our eyes have been built to assess electromagnetic wavelength. We are equipped to make mental calculations of risk and odds within the range of improbabilities that would be useful in human life. This means risks of the order of, say, being gored by a buffalo if we shoot an arrow at it, being struck by lightning if we shelter under a lone tree in a thunderstorm, or drowning if we try to swim across a river. These acceptable risks are commensurate with our lifetimes of a few decades. If we were biologically capable of living for a million years and wanted to do so, we should assess risks quite differently. We should make a habit of not crossing roads, for instance, for if you crossed a road every day for half a million years, you would undoubtedly be run over. Evolution has equipped our brains with a subjective consciousness of risk and improbability suitable for creatures with a lifetime of less than one century. Our ancestors have always needed to take decisions involving risks and probabilities, and natural selection has therefore equipped our brains to assess probabilities against a background of the short lifetime that we can, in any case, expect. If on some planet there are beings with a lifetime of a million centuries, their spotlight of comprehensible risk will extend that much farther towards the right-hand end of the continuum. They will expect to be dealt a perfect bridge hand from time to time, and will scarcely trouble to write home about it when it happens. But even they will blench if a marble statue waves at them, for you would have to live billions of years longer than even they do to see a miracle of this magnitude.
What has all this to do with theories of the origin of life? Well, we began this argument by agreeing that Cairn-Smith's theory and the primeval soup theory sound a bit far-fetched and improbable to us. We naturally feel inclined to reject these theories for that reason. But we, remember, are beings whose brains are equipped with a spotlight of comprehensible risk that is a pencil-thin beam illuminating the far left-hand end of the mathematical continuum of calculable risks. Our subjective judgment of what seems like a good bet is irrelevant to what is actually a good bet. The subjective judgment of an alien with a lifetime of a million centuries will be quite different. He will judge as quite plausible an event such as the origin of the first replicating molecule, as postulated by some chemist's theory, which we, kitted up by evolution to move in a world of a few decades' duration, would judge to be an astounding miracle. How can we decide whose point of view is the right one, ours or the long-lived aliens? There is a simple answer to this question. The long-lived alien's point of view is the right one for looking at the plausibility of a theory like Cairn-Smith's or the primeval soup theory. This is because those two theories postulate a particular event, the spontaneous arising of a self-replicating entity, as occurring only once in about a billion years, once per eon. One eon is about the time that elapsed between the origin of the Earth and the first bacteria-like fossils. For our decade-conscious brains, an event that happens only once per eon is so rare as to seem a major miracle. For the long-lived alien, it will seem less of a miracle than a golf hole in one seems to us, and most of us probably know somebody who has scored a hole in one. In judging theories of the origin of life, the alien's subjective timescale is the relevant one, because it is approximately the timescale involved in the origin of life. Our own subjective judgment about the plausibility of a theory of the origin of life is likely to be wrong by a factor of 100 million.
In fact, our subjective judgment is probably wrong by an even greater margin. Not only are our brains equipped by nature to assess risks of things in a short time, they are also equipped to assess risks of things happening to us personally or to a narrow circle of people that we know. This is because our brains didn't evolve under conditions dominated by mass media. Mass reporting means that if an improbable thing happens to anybody anywhere in the world, we shall read about it in our newspapers or in the Guinness Book of Records. If an orator anywhere in the world publicly challenged the lightning to strike him if he lied and it promptly did so, we should read about it and be duly impressed. But there are several billion people in the world to whom such a coincidence could happen, so the apparent coincidence is actually not as great as it seems. Our brains are probably equipped by nature to assess the risks of things happening to ourselves or to a few hundred people in the small circle of villages within drum range that our tribal ancestors could expect to hear news about. When we read in a newspaper about an amazing coincidence happening to somebody in Valparaiso or Virginia, we are more impressed by it than we should be. more impressed by a factor of perhaps a million, if that is the ratio between the world population surveyed by our newspapers and the tribal population about whom our evolved brains expect to hear news.
This population calculation is also relevant to our judgment of the plausibility of theories of the origin of life. Not because of the population of people on Earth, but because of the population of planets in the universe, the population of planets where life could have originated. This is just the argument we met earlier in this chapter, so there is no need to dwell on it here. Go back to our mental picture of a graduated scale of improbable events with its benchmark coincidences of bridge hands and dice throws. On this graduated scale of deleons and microdeleons, mark the following three new points. Probability of life arising on a planet in, say, a billion years, if we assume that life arises at a rate of about once per solar system. Probability of life arising on a planet if life arises at a rate of about once per galaxy. Probability of life on a randomly selected planet if life arose only once in the universe. Label these three points respectively the solar system number, the galaxy number, and the universe number. Remember that there are about 10,000 million galaxies. We don't know how many solar systems there are in each galaxy because we can only see stars, not planets, but we earlier used an estimate that there may be 100 billion billion planets in the universe. When we assess the improbability of an event postulated by, for instance, the Cairn-Smith theory, we should assess it not against what we subjectively think of as probable or improbable, but against numbers like these three numbers, the solar system number, the galaxy number, and the universe number. Which of these three numbers is the most appropriate depends upon which of the following three statements we think is nearest the truth.
1. Life has arisen in only one planet in the entire universe, and that planet, as we saw earlier, then has to be Earth. 2. Life has arisen on about one planet per galaxy. In our galaxy, Earth is the lucky planet. 3. The origin of life is a sufficiently probable event that it tends to arise about once per solar system. In our solar system, Earth is the lucky planet.
These three statements represent three benchmark views about the uniqueness of life. The actual uniqueness of life probably lies somewhere between the extremes represented by Statement 1 and Statement 3. Why do I say that? Why, in particular, should we rule out a fourth possibility, that the origin of life is a far more probable event than is suggested by Statement 3? It isn't a strong argument, but for what it is worth, it goes like this. If the origin of life were a much more probable event than is suggested by the solar system number, we should expect by now to have encountered extraterrestrial life, if not in whatever passes for the flesh, at least by radio.
It is often pointed out that chemists have failed in their attempts to duplicate the spontaneous origin of life in the laboratory. This fact is used as if it constituted evidence against the theories that those chemists are trying to test. But actually, one can argue that we should be worried if it turned out to be very easy for chemists to obtain life spontaneously in the test tube. This is because chemists' experiments last for years, not thousands of millions of years, and because only a handful of chemists, not thousands of millions of chemists, are engaged in doing these experiments. If the spontaneous origin of life turned out to be a probable enough event to have occurred during the few man decades in which chemists have done their experiments, then life should have arisen many times on Earth and many times on planets within radio range of Earth. Of course, all this begs important questions about whether chemists have succeeded in duplicating the conditions of the early Earth, but even so, given that we can't answer these questions, the argument is worth pursuing. If the origin of life were a probable event by ordinary human standards, then a substantial number of planets within radio range should have developed a radio technology long enough ago, bearing in mind that radio waves travel at 186,000 miles per second, for us to have picked up at least one transmission during the decades that we have been equipped to do so. There are probably about 50 stars within radio range, if we assume that they have had radio technology for only as long as we have. But 50 years is just a fleeting instant, and it would be a major coincidence if another civilization was so closely in step with us. If we embrace in our calculation those civilizations that had radio technology 1,000 years ago, there will be something like 1 million stars within radio range, together with however many planets circle around each one of them. If we include those whose radio technology goes back 100,000 years, the whole trillion-star galaxy would be within radio range. Of course, broadcast signals would become pretty attenuated over such huge distances.
So we have arrived at the following paradox. If a theory of the origin of life is sufficiently plausible to satisfy our subjective judgment of plausibility, it is then too plausible to account for the paucity of life in the universe as we observe it. According to this argument, the theory we are looking for has got to be the kind of theory that seems implausible to our limited, earthbound, decade-bound imaginations. Seen in this light, both Cairn-Smith's theory and the primeval soup theory seem, if anything, in danger of erring on the side of being too plausible. Having said all this, I must confess that, because there is so much uncertainty in the calculations, if a chemist did succeed in creating spontaneous life, I would not actually be disconcerted. We still don't know exactly how natural selection began on Earth. This chapter has had the modest aim of explaining only the kind of way in which it must have happened. The present lack of a definitely accepted account of the origin of life should certainly not be taken as a stumbling block for the whole Darwinian worldview, as it occasionally, probably with wishful thinking, is. The earlier chapters have disposed of other alleged stumbling blocks, and the next chapter takes up yet another one, the idea that natural selection can only destroy, never construct.
Chapter 7. Constructive Evolution. People sometimes think that natural selection is a purely negative force, capable of weeding out freaks and failures, but not capable of building up complexity, beauty, and efficiency of design. Does it not merely subtract from what is already there, and shouldn't a truly creative process add something too? One can partially answer this by pointing to a statue. Nothing is added to the block of marble, the sculptor only subtracts, but a beautiful statue emerges nevertheless. But this metaphor can mislead, for some people leap straight to the wrong part of the metaphor, the fact that the sculptor is a conscious designer, and miss the important part, the fact that the sculptor works by subtraction rather than addition. Even this part of the metaphor should not be taken too far. Natural selection may only subtract, but mutation can add. There are ways in which mutation and natural selection together can lead over the long span of geological time to a building up of complexity that has more in common with addition than with subtraction. There are two main ways in which this build-up can happen. The first of these goes under the name of co-adapted genotypes. The second, under the name of arms races. The two are superficially rather different from one another, but they are united under the headings of coevolution and genes as each other's environments. First, the idea of co-adapted genotypes. A gene has the particular effect that it does only because there is an existing structure upon which to work. A gene can't affect the wiring up of a brain unless there is a brain being wired up in the first place. There won't be a brain being wired up in the first place unless there is a complete developing embryo, and there won't be a complete developing embryo unless there is a whole program of chemical and cellular events under the influence of lots and lots of other genes and lots of other non-genetic causal influences. The particular effects that genes have are not intrinsic properties of those genes. They are properties of embryological processes, existing processes whose details may be changed by genes, acting in particular places and at particular times during embryonic development. We saw this message demonstrated in elementary form by the development of the computer biomorphs. In a sense, the whole process of embryonic development can be looked upon as a cooperative venture, jointly run by thousands of genes together. Embryos are put together by all the working genes in the developing organism in collaboration with one another. Now comes the key to understanding how such collaborations come about. In natural selection, genes are always selected for their capacity to flourish in the environment in which they find themselves. We often think of this environment as the outside world, the world of predators and climate. But from each gene's point of view, perhaps the most important part of its environment is all the other genes that it encounters. And where does a gene encounter other genes? Mostly in the cells of the successive individual bodies in which it finds itself. Each gene is selected for its capacity to cooperate successfully with the population of other genes that it is likely to meet in bodies. The true population of genes, which constitutes the working environment of any given gene, is not just the temporary collection that happens to have come together in the cells of any particular individual body. At least in sexually reproducing species, it is the set of all genes in the population of interbreeding individuals, the gene pool. At any given moment, any particular copy of a gene, in the sense of a particular collection of atoms, must be sitting in one cell of one individual. But the set of atoms that is any one copy of a gene is not of permanent interest. It has a life expectancy measured only in months. As we have seen, the long-lived gene as an evolutionary unit is not any particular physical structure, but the textual archival information that is copied on down the generations. This textual replicator has a distributed existence. It is widely distributed in space among different individuals, and widely distributed in time over many generations. When looked at in this distributed way, any one gene can be said to meet another when they find themselves sharing a body. It can expect to meet a variety of other genes in different bodies at different times in its distributed existence and in its march through geological time. A successful gene will be one that does well in the environments provided by these other genes that it is likely to meet in lots of different bodies. Doing well in such environments will turn out to be equivalent to collaborating with these other genes. It is most directly seen in the case of biochemical pathways.
Biochemical pathways are sequences of chemicals that constitute successive stages in some useful process, like the release of energy or the synthesis of an important substance. Each step in the pathway needs an enzyme, one of those large molecules that is shaped to act like a machine in a chemical factory. Different enzymes are needed for different steps in the chemical pathway. Sometimes there are two or more alternative chemical pathways to the same useful end. Although both pathways culminate in the identical useful result, they have different intermediate stages leading up to that end, and they normally have different starting points. Either of the two alternative pathways will do the job, and it doesn't matter which one is used. The important thing for any particular animal is to avoid trying to do both at once, for chemical confusion and inefficiency would result. Now suppose that pathway 1 needs the succession of enzymes A1, B1 and C1 in order to synthesize a desired chemical D, while pathway 2 needs enzymes A2, B2 and C2 in order to arrive at the same desirable end product. Each enzyme is made by a particular gene. So, in order to evolve the assembly line for pathway 1, a species needs the genes coding for A1, B1 and C1 all to co-evolve together. In order to evolve the alternative assembly line for pathway 2, a species would need the genes coding for A2, B2 and C2 to co-evolve with one another. The choice between these two co-evolutions doesn't come about through advanced planning. It comes about simply through each gene being selected by virtue of its compatibility with the other genes that already happen to dominate the population. If the population happens to be already rich in genes for B1 and C1, This will set up a climate favouring the A1 gene rather than the A2 gene. Conversely, if the population is already rich in genes for B2 and C2, this will set up a climate in which the A2 gene is favoured by selection rather than the A1 gene. It will not be as simple as that, but you will have got the idea. One of the most important aspects of the climate in which a gene is favoured or disfavoured is the other genes that are already numerous in the population, the other genes, therefore, with which it is likely to have to share bodies. Since the same will obviously be true of these other genes themselves, we have a picture of teams of genes, all evolving towards cooperative solutions to problems. The genes themselves don't evolve, they merely survive or fail to survive in the gene pool. It is the team that evolves. Other teams might have done the job just as well or even better. But once one team has started to dominate the gene pool of a species, it thereby has an automatic advantage. It is difficult for a minority team to break in, even a minority team which would, in the end, have done the job more efficiently. The majority team has an automatic resistance to being displaced, simply by virtue of being in the majority. This doesn't mean that the majority team can never be displaced. If it couldn't, evolution would grind to a halt. But it does mean that there is a kind of built-in inertia.
Obviously, this kind of argument is not limited to biochemistry. We could make the same kind of case for clusters of compatible genes building the different parts of eyes, ears, noses, walking limbs, all the cooperating parts of an animal's body. Genes for making teeth suitable for chewing meat tend to be favoured in a climate dominated by genes making guts suitable for digesting meat. Conversely, genes for making plant-grinding teeth tend to be favoured in a climate dominated by genes that make guts suitable for digesting plants, and vice versa in both cases. Teams of meat-eating genes tend to evolve together, and teams of plant-eating genes tend to evolve together. Indeed, there is a sense in which most of the working genes in a body can be said to cooperate with each other as a team, because over evolutionary time they, that is, ancestral copies of themselves, have each been part of the environment in which natural selection has worked on the others. If we ask why the ancestors of lions took to meat-eating, while the ancestors of antelopes took to grass-eating, the answer could be that originally it was an accident. An accident in the sense that it could have been the ancestors of lions that took up grass-eating and the ancestors of antelopes that took up meat-eating. But once one lineage had begun to build up a team of genes for dealing with meat rather than grass, the process was self-reinforcing. And once the other lineage had begun to build up a team of genes for dealing with grass rather than meat, that process was self-reinforcing in the other direction.
One of the main things that must have happened in the early evolution of living organisms was an increase in the numbers of genes participating in such cooperatives. Bacteria have far fewer genes than animals and plants. The increase may have come about through various kinds of gene duplication. Remember that a gene is just a length of coded symbols, like a file on a computer disk, and genes can be copied to different parts of the chromosomes, just as files can be copied to different parts of the disk. On my disk that holds this chapter, there are officially just 3 files. By officially, I mean that the computer's operating system tells me that there are just 3 files. I can ask it to read one of these 3 files, and it presents me with a one-dimensional array of alphabetical characters, including the character that I'm now reading to you. All very neat and orderly, it seems. But in fact, on the disk itself, the arrangement of the text is anything but neat and orderly. You can see this if you break away from the discipline of the computer's own official operating system and write your own private programs to decipher what is actually written on every sector of the disk. It turns out that fragments of each of my 3 files are dotted around, interleaved with each other and with fragments of old, dead files that I erased long ago and had forgotten. Any given fragment may turn up, word for word the same or with minor differences, in half a dozen different places all around the disk. The reason for this is interesting and worth a digression because it provides a good genetic analogy. When you tell a computer to delete a file, it appears to obey you. But it doesn't actually wipe out the text of that file. it simply wipes out all pointers to that file. It is as though a librarian, ordered to destroy Lady Chatterley's lover, simply tore up the card from the card index, leaving the book itself on the shelf. For the computer, this is a perfectly economical way to do things, because the space formerly occupied by the deleted file is automatically available for new files as soon as the pointers to the old file have been removed. It would be a waste of time actually to go to the trouble of filling the space itself with blanks. The old file won't itself be finally lost until all its space happens to be used for storing new files. But this reusing of space occurs piecemeal. New files aren't exactly the same size as old files. When the computer is trying to save a new file to a disk, it looks for the first available fragment of space, writes as much of the new file as will fit, then looks for another available fragment of space, writes a bit more, and so on, until all the file is written somewhere on the disk. The human has the illusion that the file is a single, orderly array, only because the computer is careful to keep records pointing to the addresses of all the fragments dotted around. These pointers are like the continued on page 94 pointers used by the New York Times. The reason many copies of any one fragment of text are found on a disk is that, if like my chapters, the text has been edited and re-edited many dozens of times, each edit will result in a new saving to the disk of almost the same text. The saving may ostensibly be a saving of the same file, but as we have seen, the text will in fact be repeatedly scattered around the available gaps on the disk. Hence, multiple copies of a given fragment of text can be found all around the surface of the disk, the more so if the disk is old and much used.
Now, the DNA operating system of a species is very, very old indeed, and there is evidence that it, seen in the long term, does something a bit like the computer with its disk files. Part of the evidence comes from the fascinating phenomenon of introns and exons. It has been discovered that any single gene, in the sense of a single continuously read passage of DNA text, is not all stored in one place. If you actually read the code letters as they occur along the chromosome, that is, if you do the equivalent of breaking out of the discipline of the operating system, you find fragments of sense, called exons, separated by portions of nonsense, called introns. Any one gene, in the functional sense, is in fact split up into a sequence of fragments, exons, separated by meaningless introns. It is as if each exon ended with a pointer saying, continued on page 94. A complete gene is then made up of a whole series of exons, which are actually strung together only when they are eventually read by the official operating system that translates them into proteins. Further evidence comes from the fact that the chromosomes are littered with old genetic text that is no longer used, but which still makes recognizable sense. To a computer programmer, the pattern of distribution of these genetic fossil fragments is uncannily reminiscent of the pattern of text on the surface of an old disk that has been much used for editing text. In some animals, a high proportion of the total number of genes is in fact never read. These genes are either complete nonsense or they are outdated fossil genes.
Just occasionally, textual fossils come into their own again, as I experienced when writing this book. A computer error, or to be fair, it may have been human error, caused me accidentally to erase the disk containing Chapter 3. Of course, the text itself hadn't literally all been erased. All that had been definitely erased were the pointers to where each exon began and ended. The official operating system could read nothing, but unofficially, I could play genetic engineer and examine all the text on the disk. What I saw was a bewildering jigsaw puzzle of textual fragments, some of them recent, others ancient, fossils. By piecing together the jigsaw fragments, I was able to recreate the chapter. But I mostly didn't know which fragments were recent and which were fossil. It didn't matter, for apart from minor details that necessitated some new editing, they were the same. At least some of the fossils, or outdated introns, had come into their own again. They rescued me from my predicament and saved me the trouble of rewriting the entire chapter. There is evidence that, in living species too, fossil genes occasionally come into their own again, and are reused after lying dormant for a million years or so. To go into detail would carry us too far from the main pathway of this chapter, for you will remember that we are already out on a digression. The main point